You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network.
Bonjour, au revoir, gracias, de nada. It's Foreign Film February. Hello, goodbye, high five. Why am I? Foreign Film February. Sit back, relax, and open your mind. Sit back, relax, and get a glass of wine. Why, you might say, it is today, and tomorrow is February. Foreign Film February. Mi amor. Music.
Welcome to the New World Pictures podcast, where we're going to talk about every movie released by New World Pictures. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
Hey, longtime listener, first time caller.
And Erica.
Soon come, Ryan. Soon come.
She'll be here eventually. And you are catching us in the middle of February. That's Foreign Film February. Well, we're talking about the foreign films released by New World Pictures. People think of New World Pictures as this grindhouse exploitation factory, but in fact, they released so many foreign films, and we're getting to a few of them in this month. We've already talked about The Story of Adele.
Now, listeners, you're probably pretty bored of that joke by now, but we're not. That cracks me up every single time.
Sorry if you're bored of it. But we're not going to be talking about that movie this time around. In fact, we're going to be talking about 1972's The Harder They Come.
Jamaica's first feature is America's number one cult movie. The harder they come, Jimmy Cliff, an existential hero as good as anything James Dean or Brando portrayed in the 50s. Crawdaddy. Yeah. In the backyard of paradise, life and marijuana are cheap. More guts, wit, humor, and sheer exuberance than most movies you'll see in any one year. Vincent Canby, New York Times. Keep on fighting for the things I want. Though I know that when you're dead, you're gone. But I'd rather be a free man in my grave than living as a puppet or a slave. So as sure as the sun will shine, I'm gonna get my share of what's mine. And then the harder they come, the harder they fall, one and all. Best rock movie of the year, Rolling Stone, LA Times, Cream. Ooh, the harder they come, the harder they fall.
That's right, 1972's The Harder They Come, brought to you by Preacher's Fix-It Shop. Do you need something fixed? We can fix it. We fix stuff. All kinds of stuff. Nothing specific, but we fix lots of things. Preacher's trusted staff of a wanderlust musician and a mean bully who has eyes for the preacher's ward won't let you down. So bring us your trusted items, whatever it is, and we will say, soon come, and you can collect your item as long as it's something that we do fix, which we can't say for sure we can.
Even things, quite honestly, that are no longer fixable.
Yeah, that, I don't know what back there.
They would be categorized generally as trash, but they can fix them.
I guess.
Yeah.
Don't know. This is directed by Perry Henzel. He was a native Jamaican who worked for the BBC before returning to Jamaica and setting up his own business, making commercials, which he did for years before starting work on The Harder They Come. In fact, he did all these commercials to be able to start working on a feature film. He meant this as the start of a trilogy of films about Jamaica and began working on the follow-up No Place Like Home, which he started just after he had finished filming this movie. But that eventually got abandoned due to a lack of funds and was not completed until 2006. And that is
Did
shortly-
you say a lack of funds with a D or a lack of funds? Fun.
Well, I mean, both kind of work really in the end, but really just a lack of money. But it was shown in I believe it was released in 2006. But in any case, it came out basically right before Perry Henzel passed away from cancer in 2006.
Mm.
This stars Jimmy Cliff in his first ever movie role. But don't worry, he would go on to appearances in Club Paradise. And I believe he is actually in a scene of Marked for Death. I know he did.
Yeah.
He did do a song with Steven Seagal.
Every road I've been, every wicked I've been, what your hands commit, I know your body must be.
At the time of filming, director Perry Henzel said that Cliff was having a little bit of trouble with his music career at the time. And so that's how he was able to convince Cliff to come back home to Jamaica. Cliff has a totally different take. As he told Variety in 2023, he said, "I was doing well in Europe music-wise. I could have stayed touring and making a lot of money, but I accepted doing the movie, which really wasn't paying anything, because I thought that I should act as I did so in school. I always loved acting, becoming other people, so when that opportunity came, I accepted. Perry told me that he actually thought I was a better actor than I was a singer. That was funny, but it struck a chord with me. I figured that I was, at the very least, as good of an actor as I was at making music."
Hmm.
He had just toured, I think, Brazil. I think he'd had a few hits, like, in England and around the world. So he was still at the beginning of his career, but he still was he was having some success. So, however, they were able to get him over to Jamaica, I'm not 100%, but that's what
probably
he says.
A plane.
Could be a boat. I don't know. It would be a long ride, but you never know. Here's where you can watch The Harder They Come. It is on Pluto. It is also on Canopy, which is a service provided by your library. So if you have a library card, you can sign up for Canopy and watch this.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
Man. Okay, then. Libraries ready to. Woo! The harder books come, the harder books fall. One and all books. They should just really, like, promote the library using that song and that movie. I feel like more people would go into a library if they knew they could watch a movie primarily about making music and smoking ganja and having a gun.
Yeah, going on a murderous rampage.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does Fellow serve up this one?
No Fellow. There was a weird icon in there that I was hoping it was Fellow, but hey, it's me, Fellow. I can't get a hold of this movie. I need to download
Phil,
it.
Just
it
get
Phil.
It from the library. Phil, just get it from the library.
I have so much money at the library. I can't go back and show my face in there. Are you kidding me? Oh, man. I rented,
Heart of the Stag, and I have not been able to return.
Oh, no. Oh, that gosh. Would be a Philo movie. Oh, no, Philo.
That would.
If you want to purchase it, though, you can also get the Shout Factory Blu-ray, which is how Eric and I watched it. On the Blu-ray, you can also watch Perry Henzel's second movie, No Place Like Home, as well, is on this disc as well. So it's quite a stack release.
No Place Like Home. No Place Like Home. One and all. One and all.
But before we move on, we need to find out what this movie is about. Mark, what is The Harder They Come about?
This one's super simple. I know that I tend to wax poetic on these descriptions. And this one, I picked it up from the very beginning. And I thought, well, maybe I'll have another description for what this movie is about the more I watch it. But it really just comes down to the lengths that a man will take when someone steals his mango.
Mmm. He'll go far.
Your life. You have a mango. You're going to give it to your mom. Someone steals it. And your life takes a serious hard left. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just be careful with those mangoes, everybody.
Mm-hmm. Erica, what is this movie about?
This movie is probably the longest music video I have ever watched.
Very true. Very true.
I like the song, don't get me wrong, but it is a bit of a longie when it comes to the video.
What's funny about it as a music video is that while it is a music video for a specific song, the title of the movie, it also includes other songs, which is funny for a music video. You don't often see them just sort of drift into other tunes as well, but then get back to the initial track, but then float to other songs.
It's a real collab.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Y'all well, love is. This episode. It's talking about libraries and collabs. Tune in.
Yeah, I liken this movie to like a Saturday afternoon listening to 91X, the San Diego alternative radio station. You're going to get some different tunes, but you're also going to hear Jeremy a lot. And I do mean the Pearl Jam song.
How much reggae they play in San Diego? Do either of you have any idea?
Yeah, well, they got Reggae Mikosa that they're going to just play reggae. So
Sunday nights, right before it turns over to an hour of Mexican National radio. Hour. Yep, exactly. Anyone from San Diego listens to this, they're going to be like, "You're dead right." But all right. For me, this movie was about once you start refurbishing bicycles, you're probably going to end up the most wanted man in your country. That's just what this teaches.
Oh, man.
Here's the Letterboxd synopsis for The Harder They Come. We are on Letterboxd, so give us a follow there if you can. Ivanhoe Martin arrives in Kingston, Jamaica, looking for work, and after some initial struggles, lands a recording contract as a reggae singer. No, he sells one song. He sells a single song.
He cuts one single. That's it. I assume the B-side was just the song again. And gets paid
without
$20.
Without him singing.
Right.
Instrumental.
He records his first song, The Harder They Come. That's true. But after a bitter dispute with a manipulative producer named Hilton, soon finds himself resorting to petty crime in order to pay the bills. He has a bitter dispute, but then sells the song and gets the money. It's just not a lot of money, so then he does resort to petty crime. He deals marijuana, kills some abusive cops, or just cops. They were tracking him down.
Corrupt cops, yes. Abusive, that's not determined in this movie. Yes.
And earns local folk hero status. Meanwhile, his record is topping the charts. That's it, guys.
Yeah.
That's how it goes.
That's the movie. It's me, Philo. Same. Dropping in to say, that's it for the Letterboxd synopsis. We're done.
Wow, Philo. What an abrupt ending to that synopsis.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I love that little, meanwhile, hey, his record did well. But all true.
Wow.
So before we dive in, we should say this is a movie that's made in Jamaica. It was made for Jamaicans, and it was based on a real life Ivanhoe Martin, the name of the character played by Jimmy Cliff, as Philo brought up to us. He was known across Jamaica as Rigging. Jimmy Cliff explained to Variety in 2023, he said, quote, "Ivanhoe was a real life character for Jamaicans. When I was a little boy, I used to hear about him as being a bad man, a real bad man. No one in Jamaica at that time had guns. But he had guns and shot a policeman, so he was someone to be feared. However, being a hero was the manner in which Perry wanted to make his name, an anti-hero in the way that Hollywood turns its bad guys into heroes." Henzel, the director, and his co-writer, Trevor Roan, who was a Jamaican playwright, they actually did a lot of research and met people who knew Ivan so they could get a better degree of accuracy. Though they did invent things because Ivan was not a musician. So that was something they added to that to reflect the current music scene in Jamaica. That said, Henzel also said the movie was about the experience of coming from the country to the city, a Jamaican coming from the country to the city, which is how the movie starts out. And what is really just 20-minute collection of moments as Ivan arrives in town on a bus, instantly gets ripped off, tells his mom that his grandmother had passed, goes to the movie to see Django, unsuccessfully looks for work, stops by a dump, basically, you know, getting used to the city.
Mm-hmm. It was like the 1970s equivalent of an Instagram story. Just random videos of your day. Just not without cutesy little superimposed animations saying, mm-hmm. you know, beach time, you know.
Yeah. None of that stuff. No meals. We had no pictures of meals, but we assumed he ate, but we got no indication.
My daughter's friend, every time that we go out to eat with her, and the food is served, she always picks up the camera and goes, camera eats first, and takes a picture of the food.
That's like the real divide of generations.
Right. Well, I'm like, stop talking. We need to eat now.
Also, have you guys seen pictures that I take of myself? Like, I'm going to make this meal look sweaty and old. Like, the picture I'm going to take of this meal is not going to be flattering. So, it's probably for the best that I just don't even try.
Because there is a generational divide. I'm going to, like, use a flash when I shouldn't. And it's all going to look a little blown out. Like, it's not going to look right.
What's with the red eyes on the salad? My God.
How can a salad have red eyes?
Really, I don't know, but it does.
You've really done it.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Why did you take a boomerang of a salad? It doesn't
even move.
I don't know.
I thought it was on picture, but it was on boomerang. Look, I didn't even take a picture of the salad. I took a short video of the salad on accident. It's just a short video of the salad.
And then I posted it to the story and all my socials. Yeah. People were like, oh,
with a little
that's
caption
salad.
That said, get in my greens.
Bon appetit, because autocorrect.
My phone just thinks appetit is a word. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You tell spell check ignore one time and it's appetit from that day forward.
Yeah. Oh,
why is that even? Mine just completely decides, no, you didn't mean that word. Here's the other word you meant. And I was like, I didn't mean, and then you send it and it's too late and you're like, I did not mean that word. Why did you switch that word? Anyway. Why did you switch apple tot? Anyway, all right. So Ivan does learn a crucial lesson in his trip around Kingston, and that is that Mr. Hilton controls the entire local music scene.
Hey! Well, what do you know? Welcome to civilization, Sarah.
That's not it.
Are you sure?
No, that's...
Sure. Sorry, I mixed it up. Sorry. This one. Got it. Sorry about
something
that.
Something slightly more authentic.
Sorry about that. My mistake.
So, Hilton, well, from morning we've been here waiting for you, sir. From 11 o'clock we've been here waiting for you.
What about?
Mr. Kenton. Send me.
Well, you have a tune?
I have a tune, yes, sir.
All right, sing it for me then.
We are all one big brother, all belong to one father. Tread on one, you hurt another. Yeah, 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 yeah. We were fashioned perfect team, made to live in unity. Let peace be our mind.
All right, that's all right. I can't use it, too slow.
To be fair to Mr. Hilton, pretty song, but yeah. That's not, you can't jam into a club to that one.
Yeah, and, I would argue slow or not. I think even in the 70s, we were way past the barbershop quartet hype. I think it was, I think he was wise in that decision.
There's an audience.
I disagree. I would be so thrilled if someone rolled up and was like, hey, I have a song for you, Erica. And then barbershop quartetted me. Barbershop apple tot is me. Apple tot in me. I would love that. I would love it. I think it would be great. Even if it was too slow, I'd be like, holy shit, listen to these fucking harmonies. You know what I mean?
They did. They did a good job. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
yes. Okay. I don't disagree. But what if that barbershop quartet decided to take sort of like a Yes's album relayer side one and was 30 minutes of straight barbershop quartetting? Like,
am I still
drive away?
Am I still allowed to continue with my day and they're just following me?
No.
Barbershop
no.
quartetting
you,
me?
You are,
I'm stuck
you
there?
Are about to exit. You're about to exit the Frogen Yozert parking lot.
Oof.
And
well, if they're barbershop quartetting me that hard, I'm probably asleep a couple minutes in. So,
okay, so you shouldn't be driving anyway.
Yeah, I shouldn't be behind the wheel. I am sleepy.
Okay, fair.
Ivan does get a job eventually from the preacher, which his mom suggested. By working for the preacher, Ivan gets two things, though. He gets a girlfriend and Elsa and a bike because of this bike, that's when he gets to deliver records to Mr. Hilton for a rally, mm-hmm. I guess, of some kind that we never see, and then suggests himself for a record.
You were sent down here to do a job.
My job is to fly the whirly bird. I've been doing that job just fine.
Did I mess up again?
It's not that one.
Okay, I'm sorry. My mistake. I mislabeled these, and it's my bad. I'm sorry about that.
I can't sing to no sir. I like the chance to make a record.
Everybody want to make a record. You almost ready?
But I have a boss song, you know, sir. This one must sell.
What time is on this?
Tomorrow. Okay, let's go.
What time tomorrow, sir?
Tomorrow. We're ready.
Okay, let's go. We're rolling again.
Tomorrow and next week.
Well, that went a whole lot better than those guys did trying to wait outside the gate. He didn't even have to sing a song. Mm-hmm.
Right. That's just what some good old-fashioned salesmanship and personality mm-hmm. will get you.
That's right. That's right. Just a little bit of that charisma. And you know what?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if this was any other kind of movie, this might be a moment where like things really turn around for Ivan. But they don't. He convinces Elsa, his now girlfriend, to give him the keys to the church so he can practice for the audition. And immediately gets caught.
Continue.
Did he have to go to the church?
Acoustics. Everybody knows that.
But he goes into the church because of the acoustics, and the amp isn't even plugged in. He's just playing. His guitarist is strumming an electric guitar with no amp. That isn't going to sound any better in a church than it would have in their apartment. So it feels a little forced.
And it didn't matter because even if you plugged in, you should have just plugged in because he heard it anyway and he busts in immediately.
Yeah.
And
he's got eagle ears. I mean, that guy.
He can hear anything.
If eagles have really good hearing, I don't know. I know that they have good eyes, but you know, in my mind, they also have really good ears. I'm
assuming their ears are also great.
Assume. I mean, I think it's bats have the really good ears, but either way, you listeners, you get my point. You get anywhere. You were with me.
I just think if you got wings, you probably can do it all.
Ears like an eagle. I hear the sea. Ears like an eagle. Let the sounds motivate me. I've got those ears like. Yeah, isn't there a song about it?
Yeah, I think there is.
That's it.
Cool.
Yeah, you don't need an ear horn if you're an eagle.
No, definitely not.
But boy, could I use one. Ivan's coworker then takes his bike and they fight over it with Ivan cutting him up with a knife. It was a key moment for the film, and not just because Ivan goes to jail and gets whipped while laying over a barrel, which comes back later as motivation for him to not want to go back to jail, but because it's the moment when Jimmy Cliff came up with the song title that would become the film's title. As he relayed to the Wall Street Journal in 2013, he said the film at the time was called Hard Road to Travel after one of my songs, and we filmed over the next year or so. When we shot the scene where Ivan cuts the bicycle store owner, Jimmy, I know you were there, but he's not a bicycle store owner. He's just a guy you work with and you fixed up the bike. Anyway, I digress. Let's get back into your story. Who really came on really hard. A line came to my mind. The harder they come. In real life, if you come on hard like that, you're going to die hard. When I told Perry my line, he loved it. he thought it was a stronger film title and asked me to write a theme song to go with it.
Well, that all makes sense. I think there was a missed opportunity to name the movie and the song Pissing in a Barrel. But
and that does have a ring to it. It does. That's pretty snappy.
Yeah.
It's drawing me right in.
I'm surprised that Corman didn't take this and then like re-release it, Pissing in a Barrel. Because, you know,
real would have been, missed opportunity.
They could have used the footage and put it in the trailer. Yeah. You know, so you're I'm going to get my money's worth if I go see Pissing in a Barrel, because guess what happens? A barrel gets pissed in. This is money well spent. You know, I'm getting what I want.
Isn't it awkward, though, when you piss at times that you shouldn't piss? Like, when you're getting lashings on your bare ass and decide, well, while I'm here, I might as well take a piss in this barrel.
Do you think it was that chill? I don't know. It didn't seem like it was that chill. I felt like just watching it, if I was nude or just bare-assed over a barrel being whipped, might I just pee uncontrollably? I don't know. Or might I just say, well, fuck it. We're already outside. My pants are off. I'm peeing. Yeah. You know? I don't know. Did you feel like him peeing was an act of defiance, or that it was like that he was being whipped so hard he was peeing?
I think it was the strength of the lashing, I think, is what forced the pee out.
No. I disagree.
This isn't like a spanking from mom, Mark.
Well, when she got that plastic spoon out, that was no joke. I'm just saying, if mom had put me over a barrel, pulled down my pants, but in the process, I had inserted my penis into a hole at the top of the barrel, I might just be like, I might as well piss. My ding-a-ling's already dangling into the hole of this barrel. The problem is, though, you're never
really thought
get
this
that.
Through.
Yeah. You're going to crunch your numbers on this. I have never been saying, more uncomfortable in a number crunch than I am right now.
The problem with it, though, I think the flaw in my theory here is, you're never going to get that piss smell out of the barrel.
No, that barrel's ruined.
Yeah, it's going to taint the whiskey a little bit, but I mean, in the
end. Sorry, Ryan, please. It's pisky, okay?
Oh, there's nothing like a good, like a fine glass of Jamaican pisky.
Barrel aged with the finest authentic piss Jamaica has to offer.
Oh man, yeah. Okay, well, freshly out of jail, Ivan records the title track. And but he does not care for the terms of the new artist deal, as we talked about in the synopsis, but we will hear him discuss it with Mr. Hilton.
Okay, I think I got this right.
You know what all the keep down here in this cave? Man, they got the books and the records of the top 500 companies. They got Defense Department budget down here. And they got the negative for all your favorite movies. They got microfilm with tax return and newspaper stories. They got immigration records and census reports, and they got official accounts of all the wars and plane crashes and volcano eruptions and earthquakes and fires and floods and all the other disasters that interrupted the flow of things in the good old US of A.
It seems like an odd like sequitur to go into, right?
It's the wrong clip, Mark. This is the wrong clip. Sorry, once again, it's the wrong clip.
Damn it. I am sorry. I am screwing this up. Man.
What's the meaning of this, sir?
I mean, you got $20 for the record.
$20, sir? That don't sound right.
How much do you think it's worth, then?
I don't really know, you know, sir.
But come on, you must have an idea. What do you think it's worth?
Well, I think at least about $200, you know, sir. I don't think I'm signing this for $20, you know, sir.
But, I mean, if he had also all the microfiche that covered all the news stories
you're
and
thinking
everything
of the first clip.
His...
You're thinking of the first clip, Mark. You didn't, oh, you were sorry. Thinking of that I, through the second clip, which I, is from this movie.
I'm just saying he could have bartered the microfiche and maybe got a little
not,
bit more
he couldn't
money
have, because that was the first clip. That wasn't this movie at all. That was Day of the Dead.
I'm having a hard time keeping the two separate right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, it's I get it. I get it. He tries to sell the song himself. He does not come away with a deal because he's not backed by Mr. Hilton, who does indeed own music in that town. So he ends up taking the deal anyway for $20.
Mm-hmm.
So his defiant move doesn't even matter. But then on the night his record comes out, he's very excited. Everyone's dancing to his song. And then he gets a deal he can't refuse.
Which I made that record, Hilton. I bet you don't get $20 for that record. Well, don't try to tell me no lie. No. I know the scene. And move if it even reach number one, not get an extent. Oh, you know that. It's all right. Tell me something. You think you can handle big money? Yes. I feel I can work up something for you now. Like what? I said I can work up something for you, man. All right. Come with me.
Now, if you... missed a few things there. He's talking about weed. So he's on the night of his record coming out and people are into it. And he's like all dressed up. His buddy's like, hey, what if we sell weed? You want to make money mm-hmm. there? So Ivan gets real into weed and his artistic dreams fall to the wayside, which basically is very realistic for anyone who starts smoking weed a whole lot.
Yeah.
Weren't you making a record? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I'm thinking a lot about the songs, though.
Right.
I'm going to get to it. I'm just like,
right. It's
taking
just
this
like,
time.
As soon as I finish all of Skyrim, I'm going to get right back to that
yeah,
record.
I just got real into that. And also this weed. But once I get through that, then I'm going to, like, think some more about the music.
Yeah.
Songs, Skyrim. And then I'm going to smoke more weed. And then I'm going to record eventually. Yeah. Yeah, makes sense. By the way, Jose there is played by Carl Bradshaw, who was a PE teacher before being cast in this movie. And he went on to basically become Jamaica's premier actor, wow. eventually earning Jamaica's Order of Distinction in 2017. Hmm. He described his experience to The Guardian in 2012. He said, "We were all amateurs, but because it was the first Jamaican film made by Jamaicans, everyone wanted to be the best they could be. Perry was a great director. We often weren't aware the camera was there because he made the surroundings so natural. The church, the Rialto, and the club were all real."
I would say that when you watch the movie, it doesn't feel like they're working on any sets. It feels very
yeah.
real.
And there was and that was because Perry Henzel was obsessed with authenticity. And he said so in interviews. He really wanted it to feel authentic because he wasn't 100% it would go beyond Jamaica, but he wanted it to feel real to Jamaicans. So that's what he was, you know. Ivan, you know, like any business entrepreneur, he's not particularly fond of the amount of money he has to pay his supplier. And that makes sense in almost any business. And this,
he's more like a franchisee, and you're going to have to pay the franchise back,
right?
You know,
why does McDonald's want me to pay the $15 to get all these cups? This pisses me off, you know. But they got to take their cut, and he ends up refusing to pay Jose, and this makes Jose then call the police and his connections there and try to put Ivan in jail for a little bit to sort him out. But as he's being chased by a police officer, he thinks back to another business that passed him by, making Pisky, where he could have...
Yeah,
I mean,
local Pisky.
And he's like, I do not want that. And so he shoots the police officer.
Farm-to-table Pisky.
You mix you if you go into a bar and you order yourself a Pisky and BB Cham, it's a delightful beverage. Wow. Those two go together so well. Oh. She ordered that baby sham. I was like, what the fuck is that drink?
Yeah, baby sham. What baby is that? Baby
sham. It's a light sparkling Perry drink that was invented in the UK. Now, what's a Perry? Wow. A Perry is fermented pears. And baby sham was a light champagne-like beverage. It's only 6% alcohol. That was really popular in the 60s and 70s. And you can still get it. But it's mostly in the UK, and it's really hard to get in the United States. Mm.
Damn, I was hoping you could get that at the library too. Yeah, I'm gonna take. I'm gonna rent Hard as They Come, and then I guess I don't know 2 liter baby sham, and then also
2 liter, dear God.
And then also.
Damn, and then you're gonna have the flavor of Perry sham in your mouth for days.
Yeah. Outlook for Dummies, and then also the latest Harry Potter, whatever number that is, 12, 13, and then I'm good to go. Yeah,
I would go grab it off the shelves, but your numbering system I do not get, and I do not approve of. You're just sitting up here,
so I figured you could go grab it.
Yeah, you figured out this crazy system, so you can go get it.
Yeah.
I was looking around for your weird shit area to find the Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Looking
over here in Mystics, trying to see if I can find it. And I don't know. Oh, shit. I realized that wasn't Mystics. That was autocorrect. That actually is a mystery. I'm sorry. I don't trust this phone. Want to see a terrible picture of some broccolini? Check this out. It was delicious, but yeah, I know. Camera does add 10 pounds. That's true. It was a very thin slice of broccolini.
Yeah. So he shot cops, and while sleeping with Jose's lady, he gets surrounded by even more police and shoots a few more of them while he escapes. And then he goes after Jose, and I thought, boy, this would really make a good song, Ivan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I
mean, you remember that music career? No? Mm-hmm. All right. But you know what? Who also thought that? Mr. Hilton. He also thought so because he starts to promote Ivan's record now that he's a wanted felon. Look, all I can say is that maybe it's not the plan, but it is a plan to become a famous musician.
Yeah.
Well, in today's day and age of viral marketing, you have to look at marketing opportunities that I guess they're outside the box of convention. And he really went well outside the box. He might have gone to another box, got out of that one, gotten another box, and stepped outside of that one. And that's where he was.
Pissed in a barrel.
Pissed in a barrel, mixed it with a little baby sham, and then said, this is my marketing strategy.
You know, some would say a marketing strategy is just to continue to produce music, but I don't know. Ryan, I don't.
If you build it, they will not come. You got to get your name out there, and you got to get people interested in you. You are your own brand.
Yeah, you're a brand. That's true.
He built a brand for himself. I mean, it did require the death of about 6 or 7 police officers.
That's right.
But it did establish a brand that everyone could rally around.
Mm-hmm.
It's true. And like any story about drug dealers, of course, this goes downhill pretty quickly, but at least he gets to drive a convertible on a golf course.
Yeah, and chase around some birds in a car. How fun. Yeah. Oh, that looked fun, I thought.
So.
And having someone drive you there first, then you get to just do the fun, silly driving. Amazing.
Yeah. Take that, Scarface.
Yeah, it was nice. It looked like a nice car, you know?
Mm-hmm. Like what kind of car was it?
1970 Mercury Cougar XR7 convertible.
Oh.
Wow. Did you know that from looking at it, or did you have to look it up?
I had to look it up. I was like, oh, it looks like a Pontiac, and was disappointed at how off I was, because Pontiac would be a GM car, Mercury would be a Ford, so I wasn't even in the same manufacturer.
Oh, man.
Embarrassing.
Yeah, embarrassing. Yeah, I had to.
All the mechanics that listen to this podcast are like, oh, Mark. Oh.
I know. I'm having a little walk of shame right now. So,
Hey, this is Jason Kleberg from the Force 5 podcast, a show that forces a guest to come up with a movie-themed top 5 list topic, and then we reveal our picks on air. Top 5 heist films, top 5 tearjerkers, top 5 movie dogs. Every show you'll be asking yourself, what would be on my list? Guests include directors, screenwriters, actors, podcasters, musicians, authors, and even a professional wrestler. Subscribe to the Force 5 podcast, and you won't just be a listener, you'll be a list nerd. The Force 5 podcast, available wherever you're listening now.
It's time for things we loved and things we hated.
That's right. It's time to talk about things we loved and things we hated about The Harder They Come. Mark, what is something you loved?
I talked about it already. I loved the fact that there aren't...
Oh, well then never mind. Erica...
Okay. I talked about mine already too, Brian. Great segment. Great segment.
Glad we do this.
No, let's go to Hayden. Let's do this.
Okay. All right. Well, I didn't say mine, which is I did love all the little world building, some of the smaller scenes that seemed arbitrary at the time, but then they have significance later, such as them all seeing Django in the movie theater. It feels like, what are we doing? But then it becomes very significant at the end, sort of the mirrored of people seeing the hero and thinking, can the hero die in a movie? Anyway, little things like that, which I thought were very cool.
Ryan loves the little things.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to things we hated. Mark, what is something you hated?
I really hated that when Ivan goes to the recording studio and there is a group that's already recording, that it just seems like this thing is not mic'd well. Like, it's going to sound like garbage, this recording. They're all playing live. The only people that I can see with mics are the guys singing, and they don't have headphones on. And the band is playing live, which is going to be loud as shit, and they're not going to be able to hear themselves. And the mics that they're singing into, they're all in a small room. It's going to pick up the sound of everybody else. I just was like, this is a terrible recording studio.
Mm. Yeah.
There's also way too many people in the booth, which is the thing that I thought of.
Yes.
Which I was like, yeah. No, you don't get to just walk into the booth because you got a delivery. Like, what's the security system? There's already, we already have five or six extra people we don't need.
Well, you don't need to worry about someone interrupting and making noise in the background that's going to pick up, because all the mics are just picking up all the cacophony of sound that's being made in that studio. Also, a studio, it felt hotter than I would want a studio to be in when I was recording.
Yes, he was soaked after they were done recording.
Thick sweat. I was like,
soaked.
Thick. It is swampy in that studio.
Right. Yeah.
Right. But maybe they were on the side making sweat ski.
Is it a hot summer day and too hot for pisky? Sweat ski. Cool off with a thick, salty glass of sweat ski.
Yeah, smooth taste, but more salt than you would like.
Way more salt.
Erica, what is something you hated?
This is gonna make me sound like a jerk, but I didn't enjoy having the whole element with the child. I'm forgetting the child's name right now.
You think it's like Rupert? Am I wrong?
Rupert? Yeah, I think so.
He's kind of a late addition that his mom has passed.
Yeah, it was a late addition, and I don't know. I don't think it added anything. It felt forced in there. I don't think it furthered the story or world builded or had the impact that maybe it seemed like it was going to have on paper. You know, I didn't care for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I agree. There were some, definitely, as much as I like the little things that sort of built up, some of those things didn't build up. So there were some things that seemed a little superfluous, but for me, I felt like, and we've kind of said this, but this is like two different movies.
Mm-hmm.
One is the guy from the country coming to the city and trying to become a musician. And the other one is a guy who becomes a drug dealer and then becomes sort of an anti-hero and sort of becomes celebrated in the city. And it's kind of two things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And around the hour mark is where it sort of switches over to the anti-hero story. And you're like, I mean, there's a way to, you could have blended them a bit more together. So mm-hmm. they could have made a little bit more sense. It feels more like here's a story and here's another. Not that they're bad or anything. It just feels like two movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, I wanted the story about the music and somebody else wanted the story about the anti-hero. And so we just threw them both together.
You mentioned at the beginning, like the first half hour of this movie has really no plot. It's just random events. Like he spends a considerable amount of the movie going around and begging for dimes. And I'm not talking about dime bags. I'm talking about, hey, give me
just
a dime.
Just money. Yeah.
Like it, and trying to find a job and saying, when they say no, saying, give me a dime. And that's like the first 20 minutes of the movie. And then you get a little bit of a music career in there. And then now it's this anti-hero story that takes over. I think they could have tightened up that first hour and integrated where the anti-hero part could have come in. They could have introduced the drug dealers. They could have introduced the corrupt cops. They could have introduced even how how Hilton, the record guy, is controlling the music and working with the cops, like a little earlier to like build the tension of the world that they were living in.
Yep. All right, let's go to our favorite scene. Mark, what was your favorite scene?
Hands down. The album is about to be played at the club. Ivan is stoked. He's bought himself a new outfit. He's got his Lady Elsa address. And she is like, no. I've been walking around looking for a job all day. I am not going dancing. And he begs and pleads. And she is hard no.
Come with me, now. You don't even have to dance. No. I'm tired. I've been walking and looking for work all day. I'm not like you.
You want me to go and beg work when I have a record? I'm done with that. I'm not done with it, though. I was walking all day.
It's rare in the movies that we watch that a scene comes along that I am like, man, that is me. That is 100% me. And me, I was Elsa in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in that moment. I mean,
for sure. Erica, what was your favorite scene?
Oh, my favorite scene was with the DJ when we finally get to see the local DJ kick off some songs.
Well, the DJ, voice. The DJ in this clip, we get a little bit of him talking to Ivan when Ivan's trying to get him to play his record, and then we see the DJ in the booth doing his announcement.
Yes,
so just track.
But we hear his real voice, his real DJ voice.
But the DJ, the DJ at the dance is Prince Buster.
No, this is the DJ of the radio DJ.
Oh, the radio DJ. Okay, radio DJ. I thought you were talking about the one at the dance, because Buster was pretty famous.
Yeah.
It's personal of mine. I'm an independent producer as well.
Well, like I said, I did with Hilton Direct. You know, this is show business, baby. No business. No show.
Hey, good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Big T Show. Back in my home where the sweet soul sisters roam. My mojo working and my soul sort of cooking and smoking. Like we say, the T thing goes for 4 hours long, and it's the sound of soul in Big Boss Country right here. Hey, I hear my little ring-a-ling going on, so let's see what's happening outside in Radio Land.
Amazing. Amazing.
Amazing.
I mean, that is also a real radio DJ. That was real life Jamaican DJ Don Topping, who was known as Numero Uno, as Ivan calls him in the film. So they did fill this movie with lots of real people in Kingston.
His real name
Jamaica.
Is actually Don Thompson, but because of autocorrect, it just comes through as Don Topping.
That's what happened at the hospital.
Just went with it.
When he was born.
Just went with it.
Yeah.
Ryan, how about yourself? What was your favorite scene?
My favorite scene was the chase scene of Jose at the end of the movie, where he chases Jose down. Particularly once I found out that, like, as Jimmy Cliff mentioned in one of the quotes that we got for him, guns were not prevalent. And I believe the only gun that they had for this film was from the actor who played Jose, Carl Bradshaw, who had a starter pistol to use in races because he was a PE coach. That was the only gun that they had. And so because of this, on the Shout Factory disc in one of the interviews, one of the DPs, Franklin St. Juste, explained that he had to shoot each actor individually with the gun because he couldn't shoot them together because they only had one gun.
Wow.
But isn't he holding two guns in several of the scenes?
Well, he's holding two. Yeah, he might have two guns at one point in time, but they only had one gun for that particular section.
Okay. All right.
As we'll learn in the research, they shot this in a couple of different sections. So,
okay.
I just really like that part of it. And the fact that also when he's chasing him, he's running down the river and people are throwing stuff at him. Mm-hmm. He's, Carl Bradshaw even said that like that was real. He said, I was running for my life because people were just picking stuff off the ground and throwing them at him. People just got excited and started throwing stuff at him. And he was like, they were throwing anything they could grab. So he was truly
that's
racing.
Wild.
Yeah. All right. Let's get into some final questions. Here are final questions for The Harder They Come. Once Ivan becomes a criminal, why doesn't he ever track down that snow cone salesman he met that stole all his stuff when he first arrived in town?
Stole the mango.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's. Yeah. You, that's
you
the
think
guy
that would
that you
be
gotta,
his first revenge.
Yeah.
You know, would be that guy, but.
Yeah. I mean, it's like now you're a criminal. Like, take that dude. I mean, he has a giant cart he's going around town in. Like, you can find
sure.
him. Sure. He's not hiding out in the middle of nowhere.
It seems like he could have tracked down Snow Cone Guy pretty easily. I mean, he's able to find Pedro and Jose and, like, he's able to find people.
Yeah.
Pretty
yeah.
easily.
I mean, he's around. Speaking of characters that show up and disappear, were you surprised that Ivan's mom only had one scene?
No, because she didn't want him there. She said he couldn't stay, and she was kind of like, oh, nobody told me that mom died? Bummer. Where's my mango? Oh, you don't have it? All right, get out.
Yeah, so, I didn't think we would see her at all, so.
Okay, well then follow up. What was mom up to that she left them behind in country and did not want him to come to city and mess up what she had going there?
Wouldn't you like to know? She's just doing her thing.
Yeah.
Okay. He's a grown ass man. She would like just some time to herself. All right. Yeah.
Go back to country. She says like,
yeah,
I have shit going on here that's working great.
I have a life this up. Here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, going back to the snow cone cart, maybe he didn't want that because it was just his dirty laundry and he was going to his mom's house to do laundry.
Yeah.
So he might have been like, I don't really need it anyway.
I'm kind of awesome that he would then take his dirty laundry and like put it in a box and then wrap that box into some paper and then put some twine around that box to be like, I want to be able to carry this laundry, but I want it to look nice. Like a present, like a gift for my mom when she unwraps it and realizes it's dirty. I need you to clean it.
You don't do that at home? I do. I always wrap it up and I just set it right on the washer and I'm like, someone's great present.
I spent an hour wrapping this up. Now, some would say you could have used that time to clean it. But to that I say, you don't know how good my mom does laundry.
Look, I'm going to be honest. I had a tall glass of Sweatsky. I was a little out of it. And I just wrapped up my dirty laundry.
I wrapped it up. I took a couple of shots of Pisky. And then I was like, I'm out. I got to watch some Django and then go to bed. Let's get to some research. Let's talk about this movie.
Research sponsored by Philo.
It's my favorite part. Really? Do you want to be our sponsor for this section, Philo? No, I don't.
Oh, this is just too much fun for words.
That's right.
Ryan's Research, also known as autocorrect, Ryan's Recipe.
It's Brian's Recipe.
Yeah, Brian's Recipe.
Bone apple tart. It's Ryan. It's time for Ryan's Recipes. All right. So this movie was made for either $300,000. I also read $400,000 on Super 16 millimeter film. The reason being is that instead of regular 16, Super 16 millimeter, as Perry Henzel explained, when it was blown up to 35 millimeter, you don't lose parts of the frame. And it was a brand new film stock at the time, so it was an exciting thing to shoot things on because it was different. Anyway, according to the first DP of the movie, David McDonald, who was from England, and he came over to Jamaica to shoot. I think he's probably somebody that Perry Henzel knew while he worked for the BBC. And he was the initial DP. There were two more that eventually would shoot the movie. But he said he started in 1968, and I know there were subsequent shoots. This movie doesn't come out till 72. David McDonald said that he shot for 10 to 12 weeks and then the film went bankrupt. So they would sporadically shoot or reshoot. I couldn't get the when exactly they would redo all the stuff that they shot, how they would keep bringing back Jimmy Cliff. I don't know. But in any case, the movie was shot like in chunks, essentially, before it was totally put together. Jimmy Cliff was supposed to write not just the title track, he's also supposed to write all the songs for the soundtrack, but he never did. In fact, leaving the director, Perry Henzel, or Henzel, to try to actually ask him, are you going to write the music? And he was like, no. He was like, okay. Wow. So he had like, to.
Yeah. But the thing is, I just got Fallout.
Right.
I'm going to play Fallout for a bit.
I got the expansion pack, and I just feel like I got to give that my attention.
You got to give that my attention right now. I also ordered
a pizza. It's kind of made me really excited for the game again, because I'd already played it. But now with the expansion pack, it's like fresh again. But
hey, man, what'd you get here? Oh, shit. Have you been here the whole time? Have we been chatting? Shit, man. I don't know.
So this left Perry Henzel to go fill the soundtrack with songs from a bunch of different artists. So he went and just picked out a bunch of songs, including a couple more from Jimmy Cliff that he agreed to use for the soundtrack. They used money from Island Records. The owner of Island Records is one of the people that helped them pay for the rest of the movie. So I'm sure that that was also due to the fact that he was going to release the soundtrack, which they did. And the soundtrack was a huge success and is often cited as what helped break reggae music into the United States. And I can say from personal experience is a record that is great to DJ with in bars in the Bay Area, as I did. Anyway.
Man, Ryan's Recipe is a trip. You're going to always learn something new about it that like... You didn't even know. It's like an onion. Like, you just think you, like, know everything about it, man. And then he just drops the craziest, like story. And you're like, no way, man. No way.
But seriously, though, can we not download the expansion pack of the Ryan's Recipes?
Yeah. Can you get it at the library or what?
Because I feel like whatever he's got is enough. I don't need the expansion pack.
Yeah.
Also, I'm not going in the library because they like look at me and like they know.
Too many people in the library. There's too many people in the library. I'm not going to the library.
It's too quiet in there, man. It's too quiet.
You could just hear. It's like the sounds just reverberating off the walls of emptiness, and it's like, plus, I can't do it, man.
Plus, I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't like the sound of pages turning.
Out, man. It's like nails on a chalkboard, man. Like hearing those pages turn, it's gross, dog. Just, it's like,
guys, we're still recording. Do you want us to stop or are you guys ready to do another take of the song or
wait, where did you get here?
Holy shit.
What?
How long has Mr. Hilton been here?
That's where he's like, I'm paying you $20. That was
yeah.
It's like, you're lucky you're getting $20. That was way too much.
What we didn't see was that they had just spent the previous 90 minutes singing a cappella songs, like barbershop quartet style. He was over it.
Speaking of the music, this is what Jimmy Cliff told the Wall Street Journal about the lyrics for the title track. He said, "The lyrics came from my past. I grew up in the church and had always questioned what they were telling me. Like the promise of a pie in the sky when you die. The second verse about oppressors trying to keep me down kind of reflected my own life coming out of the ghetto in Jamaica and fighting the system. I wanted the song to have a church feel and to reflect the environment I grew up in, the underdog fighting all kinds of trickery." Mission accomplished.
Yeah. It's a good song.
So I also found it kind of funny in the film that, like, he records the song. You really see them recording the song. I believe that's when they actually recorded the song. They only had one day in the studio. So as difficult as it was in the studio, Mark, they had one day to pull off everything they had to do. The movie is initially released in Jamaica, of course, in June of 1972 at the Carib Theater. As Hensel told the Miami Herald, he said it was incredible. 6,000 people surrounded the theater. They broke down the doors and rushed in.
Wow.
The audience was so many that they crammed three to a seat by the time the projector started rolling. So, and then other stories from other crew members is that they came out of the theater and there was such a huge crowd still outside. They were like, what was the movie like? What was the movie like? So they were very excited by it. It started playing some festivals, and it won an award at the Venice Film Festival. And then in November 1972, the film played the Los Angeles International Film Festival. After which, director Perry Hensel shopped the film all over town, but no studio would touch it, not even American International Pictures. Enter Roger Corman, who bragged to the LA Times in February 1973 that he outbid Warner Brothers for the movie. But again, the director has a different story to tell, but that's okay. Apparently, Corman gave Hensel a $75,000 advance for the distribution rights, in which case I would say Warner Brothers couldn't beat that. I don't know. I know this is 1973 money, but that still feels like they could have beat that. But in any case.
He called someone at Warner Brothers. They're like, yeah, Roger, we're going after that movie too.
Yeah. Oh, you got us. Oh, well.
Yeah.
I guess we'll just put out the Roger many big budget literally. Movies we
like
have
very
planned.
Literal.
Yeah. Right. You know, he was a salesman too. You know, he was always a salesman. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's right. The movie in the U.S. opened February 9th, 1973 in New York City in two different theaters. It got mixed reviews and was kind of marketed more like a blaxploitation film, which makes sense for New World Pictures that's how they would see it. But that was not something that Hensel appreciated. So he and New World had disagreements because Hensel thought it was more of like a college film. It should be targeted to college kids and younger people, not a blaxploitation film. So he took over the distribution for the Boston premiere and did press with colleges and a whole bunch of stuff. And so when it opened at the Orson Welles Theater in Boston, it ran for another 7 years. At that theater.
Wow.
Dang.
Yeah. Nice. Apparently, Jimmy Cliff, when he would tour in town, he would go to like an afternoon showing and he would leap up on stage, like his pose with the two guns, just for the afternoon screening.
That's cool.
The film also had an extended run as a midnight movie in Manhattan's Elgin Cinema. So it became had this audience. It became a cult film. Hensel didn't like it being referred to as a cult movie because he was like, it's played all over the world and it's played for so many different audiences. But I'm like, I'm sorry, a movie plays for 7 years and it's a midnight movie for years in New York. I don't know. That's a cult movie to me, you know? Certainly found a crowd for sure.
Yeah.
Hensel also said that it took him 6 years of touring the movie for him to be able to pay back his investors. And then it went into profit. So money problems are sort of what maybe stilted Hensel's movie career. And maybe this is from his lack of experience with film distribution. So in 1976, co-writer Trevor Roan complained to the Miami Herald in a piece that he had only received $1,200 from the movie. This is several years its run.
Wow.
And he felt the film's profits were being mismanaged. And Hensel, you know, his credit, he accepted that criticism, and he explains, he said, quote, "It's hard to believe where the money goes to. Of the box office dollar, 75 cents goes to the theater owner. The producer gets 30% of what's left. The bloody picture in America has grossed about 1 million, and we have 80,000. The percentages do not make sense. I'm not accusing New World Pictures. They gave us the standard contract, and as rough as the American thing is, it's worse than just about every other part of the world." So, now, though, I would say also in this article, in the Blu-ray and the special features, for all the reasons I mentioned, Hensel isn't very quick to give New World much credit for the film's success. But in this article, he admitted that he was attempting to get New World to re-release the film and invest in an advertising campaign because of its cult success, something that I did not see evidence of. So I have to assume it didn't happen. It's not something that once Corbin has made his money, he usually moved on. He would only rename and then redo a new trailer and all that stuff when the film had not been a success.
Yeah.
So he clearly got what he needed from it and he moved on.
Mm-hmm.
He also only had put up $75,000 as an advance at that point in time. Let's not forget when we did Cries and Whispers, Whispers and Cries, one of the first foreign films that he put out that was really funded by them selling the rights in advance to Films Inc., which is a company that put films like in prisons and airplanes and other like non-theatrical services. So they had the money to then give the advance to get the Bergman film. And I imagine they did the same thing with this. So he probably didn't have to worry about a whole new campaign. So, but because of that, and because he probably asked them to 4 years or 3 years later to, "Hey, why don't you do another campaign? It's doing so well." And he didn't. That may be why he left a little sour on New World Pictures and his experience with his film there. Now that's Perry's view. Let's go to the movie world of Roger Corman.
Okay, let's do it. Counterpoint. Let's do it.
Roger, the sound of those pages turning, though, dog. Oh, horrible.
Oh man, just why?
Ew.
I don't like to go to the library.
So dry and papery.
Here's what he says. "The Harder They Come is a very interesting film. It was a reggae film done in Jamaica." Written. Yep.
I think Letterboxd has a better description than him so far. So far.
Yeah. Spoken like somebody who loves reggae music. Written and directed by Perry Hensel and on a very low budget. It won awards at a couple of regional film festivals. Also, some international ones, but that's okay. "We liked the film very much and took it for distribution, but did not have great success with it originally, although it got very good reviews. However, we stayed with it and eventually started playing it in New York as a midnight feature on Friday and Saturday nights. It ran that way for a whole year. We followed that pattern around the country, and after 2 years, it became something of a cult film and ultimately was commercially successful. Again, I'm very proud to be able to handle a very good but difficult film by finding good but different ways of releasing it and turning it into a success."
Yeah. Fair.
All right.
Okay. Try again.
Yeah. That's right. But that's it.
Wow.
That is it for The Harder They Come. We've got one more film in February. So make sure you check out our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com. And we'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast, part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.
"We're getting to make this a habit, man. Pointing guns at each other, you know.